in that piece, I will be immensely happy.
Well, Keith Grant, I'm very glad that we obeyed the command of Votan. How can you refuse it? And had you with your music on the programme. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Keith Grant was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the actor, playwright and director Stephen Berkoff. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall. Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly. Welcome along to the afternoon here on Radio 3, which continues in just a moment with a chance to hear the music of two little-known English composers from the 17th century, one of whom was the father of a very famous English poet. Find out who he was in the Early Music Show, which follows a summary of the BBC News this lunchtime, read by David Cornett.
The Taliban says a series of coordinated attacks in Afghanistan mark the start of its spring offensive. Most of the assaults were launched in the capital, Kabul, where foreign embassies and the country's parliament building were targeted. But attacks were reported in at least four other provinces, including Jalalabad, where the airport came under siege. The Labour leader, Ed Miliband, has offered to limit donations to his party from trade unions to £5,000. But he said he wanted to keep the system whereby individual union members are asked if they want to keep paying £3 a year to Labour. The Conservatives say unless those donations are tackled, Mr Miliband's proposals are virtually meaningless. A group of 46 philanthropists have called on the government to rethink plans to limit tax relief on charitable donations. In a letter to the Sunday Telegraph, they said the cap could deter future donors. Ministers have said they want to stop wealthy people reducing their tax bills, sometimes to zero, by giving to charity. There's been more fighting between government forces and rebels in Syria ahead of the expected arrival of United Nations ceasefire observers in Damascus tonight. Syrian opposition activists say forces loyal to President Assad have resumed shelling of the central city of Homs. The blast furnace at the former Cora Steelworks in Teesside will be relit this afternoon, more than 2 years after production stopped. The plant was bought by a company in Thailand, SSI. They've taken on more than 1,000 workers, and it's thought further jobs could be created. The RSPCA has called for a number of changes to be made to the Grand National after two horses died during the race yesterday. The charity says the number of horses taking part should be reduced, and it was also concerned about the design of the jumps. A minute's silence has been observed in Belfast, where the Titanic was built to mark the centenary of the ship's sinking. Bronze plaques listing the names of those who died were unveiled in a memorial garden in the city this morning. And the weather, a dry and mostly sunny day. It'll feel rather chilly, but it'll be pleasant in the sunshine. BBC News and weather at 1:03.
David, thank you very much. The late quartets of Shostakovich are the subject of our Sunday concert this afternoon. The Pacifica Quartet play the number 11, the 12th and the 13th in an hour from now in a recital recorded last month at Wigmore Hall in London. But next, this lunchtime, it's time for today's Early Music Show, which is introduced by Catherine Bott.
Thank you. The Fall of the Leaf, one of the most famous pieces from the 17th century Fitzwilliam virginal book, in an arrangement for recorder and lute, played by Hans Martin Linder and Konrad Ragosnich. The Fitzwilliam virginal book is a treasury of 297 keyboard pieces by various composers, dating from about 1562 to 1612, and that little ditty was one of four pieces in the collection by Martin Pearson, who's the focus of today's early music show. Later in the programme, I'll be talking to Richard Rastall, Professor Emeritus of Leeds University, whose work in editing and reconstructing Pearson's works over more than 20 years has been a considerable labour of love. But before we hear from Richard, let's hear one of those pieces he's so lovingly helped to restore. This is Pearson's Latin motet, Quid Vobis Videtur, and it's sung by the ex-cathedra consort conducted by Geoffrey Skidmore.
Thank you.
Geoffrey Skidmore conducted the Ex Cathedra Consort in the Latin motet Quid Vobis Videtur by Martin Pearson. I've come to the home of Professor Richard Rastall in Leeds. Richard, tell me a little about his life and times.
He was born around 1571 in March, Cambridgeshire. He lived right through the rest of the Elizabethan period, through the early Stuart period, and through the Civil War and into the Commonwealth. So like Tomkins, he was a very old man who saw an awful lot of life. We don't know very much about the first 30 years of his life. He collaborated with Ben Jonson in 1604 on the May Day celebration for the King and Queen. He was convicted of recusancy 2 years later with Ben Jonson. He graduated Bachelor of Music from Oxford in 1613, so he must by then have been a good Anglican. And from then on, his career really took off. He was published a good deal, two songbooks of his own and in other people's publications. He became sacrist at Westminster Abbey and almoner and master of the choristers at St Paul's Cathedral in 1625. And he stayed as almoner, even though the cathedral was closed down. He was also married four times, if our information is correct.
So when you said he saw a lot of life in a long lifetime, he really did.
Well, his last marriage must have been when he was in his late 70s, I think. So, yes, he was a get-up-and-goer.
That's quite a life. But what about the music? Because you have been digging into this perhaps rather neglected composer. And what makes you think that he's undeservedly neglected?
I think it's simply the quality of the music. When you hear it really well performed, you realise just how high that quality is. And indeed, it's very good music to perform as well as to listen to. And that means that it's worth resurrecting.
He lived in a time when, for church music, for sacred music in general, devotional music, whether it was for church or home, the language was really to go with the Anglican Church. It was the vernacular, it was English. And yet he obviously loved to write, to set Latin texts. Why was that?
Well, there was no reason why you shouldn't set Latin in a secular song. And actually, of course, an educated person, as he must have been, would have been pretty conversant with Latin. So a Latin text was a perfectly sensible thing to set. And I think the recusancy was actually just a passing phase, probably because of a friendship with Ben Jonson. And he obviously got out of that quite quickly.
Well, we're going to hear another glorious Latin motet now, Laboravi ingemitum meo. Can you tell us something about the piece? Because you needed to put a lot of work in with this one so that we can all hear and enjoy it in the 21st century.
Yes, all these Latin motets, 15 of them, survive in an incomplete source. It was originally a set of five-part books. There are now only four. So the cantus part has had to be reconstructed for all of these motets. Laboravi ingemitum meo is two verses from Psalm 6. He sets it in a way that I think is really gut-wrenching, if I can use a word like that in a Jacobean piece. I think it's amazingly affecting. And this is typical of Pearson. I think he had the knack of getting to the heart of a text and writing suitable music for it.
Thank you.
I have laboured with my groaning. I will wash my bed through each successive night. I will water my coverlet with my tears. Martin Pearson's Latin motet, Laboravi in Gemitu Meo, sung by the ex-cathedra consort, conducted by Geoffrey Skidmore. Richard Rastall, we're moving on now from your work on Pearson's sacred vocal music to the different musical texture offered by Fretwork, Viol Consort, and their recent recording of the additions and reconstructions you've made of Pearson's complete instrumental music. Now, the word reconstruction, it's a bit of a weasel one, isn't it, Richard? Because sometimes it can mean rebuilding when you've only got the foundations to go on, and sometimes it's like the last pieces of a jigsaw. Which of those two ideas applies to Martin Pearson's music?
With the music of this period, it's really the jigsaw. What usually happens is that a set of part books is used in a rehearsal. People take them home to practice during the week, and then they don't bring them back again. So you get an incomplete set of part books, and you have to reconstruct one or more parts. That's a very tricky affair, because you need to know not only how the music works, but the style of the period and the style of the particular composer. And for instance, it's very difficult to know when the reconstructed part shouldn't be singing at all, when it should be resting. So it's a complex process, but a very satisfying one if you can do it well.
Well, I can see that there's the scientific aspect to this, but there's probably no substitute for having steeped yourself in Pearson's music so that you could almost compose as him. Have you steeped yourself in his music? You must have done.
Well, I suppose so, over the years, yes, because it took a long time to reconstruct the 15 Latin motets, for example, and I think I did learn a lot about Pearson's style. If you don't, then there's no point in doing it. You can't be writing free counterpoint when you're reconstructing a piece by a known composer. You've got to take what's there, work out what the composer was doing with it, and then guess as closely as you can what he actually did.
Were you conscious, or have you always been conscious, of having a duty to Martin Pearson's shade?
In a sense, yes. And of course, it's terrifying when you're reconstructing. I've certainly been very fond of Pearson's music for a long, long time. I met it first in Marilyn Wales's editions of the 1960s when I was an undergraduate. And then I found out that Audrey Jones had actually written an M.Litt thesis on Pearson. And her work, her documentary work and her assessment of the music was absolutely revelationary. And we owe a lot to Audrey for her work on Pearson, I think.
Well, we're going to hear two of Pearson's six voice consort pieces now. And they seem to fall into one of two categories, these consort pieces. Richard, you can explain much better than I can, because you can do it at first hand.
Yes, most of them are fantasies. That's to say, you take a tune, you work it, you take another tune, you work it, and so on through the piece. And his invention in those works is absolutely extraordinary. The other type of piece here is the Almain, which is, of course, a very simple little dance, basically in two sections, each section repeated. And here, Pearson tends to move the material around from one voice to another, so that you can actually hear, again, the material being swapped between two different groups of instruments across the table.
Thank you.
Fretwork with two consort pieces in six parts by Martin Pearson. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, and today I'm in Leeds with Professor Richard Rastall, whose edition of Martin Pearson's music we're hearing throughout the programme. Richard, why and for whom did Pearson write these consort pieces?
Well, I wish I knew. They're all domestic pieces, of course, and since Pearson was almoner and master of the children at St Paul's, he would have been in charge of their training as consort violists. So I think it's quite possible that the six-part pieces were written for the boys to learn on. The other piece, the five-part fantasy that survives, is a different matter, and I think that may have been written for his professional friends, because he would have had two different types of meeting in his house, I think, one with the boys, part of their training, and one with his friends who would come to play just for fun and to hone their skills as well. Now, the five-part fantasy, which is called Attendite, is another one I've had to reconstruct because the second tenor part is missing. But that's technically difficult to perform, and it's also intellectually much more challenging. It's a piece in D minor, modal D minor, but it actually goes into D-flat major towards the end, which is a key so unusual that he notated the G-flats as F-sharps. And then, in a matter of about seven bars, he returns to D minor. It's an absolutely extraordinary piece of writing, and I think the first players must have wondered where on earth he was taking them when they got into the middle of this one.
Thank you.
fretwork with the five-part viol fantasia by Martin Pearson with the extremely relevant title, Attendite. Listen. Obviously, a very difficult piece if you're not listening. And although I think probably Martin Pearson must have been very cross with the player who took away the second tenor part and didn't come back with it.
It's two players, actually. There are two copies of this piece, and there are two parts missing from each copy, and the second tenor is missing from both. So second tenors as a whole have a bad press.
An unreliable lot, and giving you, yes, Richard Rastall, much more work to do in the 21st century.
I should say that I play second tenor in my own consorts.
But you know where every bit of the music is, don't you? You haven't lost any.
That's right.
What's special about Pearson's music? Nowadays we have to think of a USP, a unique selling point. What sets him apart from his contemporaries as a composer?
Goodness, I think his sheer skill as a composer, his ability to know what effect he's aiming for and how to get it, and the inventiveness of it. Whatever he does, it's something that's better than you expected and something that may be quite unexpected but fits all the same. That's true for any great composer, isn't it? And I don't say Pearson's a great composer, but he was a very, very good one.
Now, Pearson is not the only composer featured in today's programme. We're going to talk a little now about another composer who deserves attention, and this is John Milton. Perhaps not the John Milton one might expect. Richard, tell me about him.
John Milton the Elder was the poet's dad, yes. He's one of a group, actually. There are other composers who fit this bill. But Milton lived very close to the east end of St Paul's Cathedral, three plots down from Cheapside, just round the corner from St Mary le Bow. And if he looked out of his front windows, he would have seen that vast east end of the cathedral. He was a very successful scrivener. That's to say, he produced legal documents and he wrote them out. He was a moneylender as well. He must have been a very wealthy man eventually. But he was a part-time amateur composer. And I enjoy his music enormously. I've edited all of it now. It's great stuff, quite unlike Pearson's. Thank you.
John Milton Sr.'s pieces for viol consort, performed by fretwork. Richard, is there any evidence that Milton and Pearson knew each other or perhaps worked together? I rather hope so.
There's no evidence, no, but it would be amazing if they didn't know each other. They knew a lot of the same people, they were published in the same publications, and they lived very close to one another. I mean, Bread Street's only a stone's throw from the east end of St Paul's, as I said, and Pearson's house, of course, was on the south side of St Paul's, by the cloister. They have to have known each other. They were also both involved in the first decade of the 17th century in the Blackfriars Theatre. And I imagine that they may both have written music for the Blackfriars Theatre, though I don't know of any pieces that survive from that. It would be amazing if they didn't know each other.
You've chosen another piece by Milton, again in six parts, and this one includes a heartfelt vocal line. Do we suppose that possibly Milton Jr. might have written this, or was Milton Sr. up to writing his own lyrics?
Oh, Milton Sr. Is known to have written poetry. He was, I imagine, an influence on his son in that regard. There are two poems known to be by him, but I suspect that other poems that he set to music were actually his as well, and this is one of them. This piece is an in nomine, which is a genre which was quite old by the early 17th century. It's a chunk of chant from Gloria Tibi Trinitas, which John Taverner used in his Mass of that name at the moment where the Mass words are Benedictus qui venit in nomine Domini, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And these 54 notes, or whatever, I think it's 54, were used by many composers, both before and after Milton. And this is a six-part setting of that tune, but unusually he set words to the in nomine tune, and I think those words could well be by him.
If that a sinner's sighs sent from a soul oppressed may pierce the firmament and mount the throne where great Jehovah sits, the God of rest, then hear, O Lord, the sad tune of my moan. O gracious God, whose goodness gives me light, receive my tears and prayers in thy sight.
So
Michael chants with members of fretwork in that penitent in nomine by John Milton Sr., father of the poet of Paradise Lost. We heard an arrangement of one of Martin Pearson's keyboard pieces at the beginning of the programme. That came from the Fitzwilliam Virginal book. Sophie Yates, playing virginals, makes a contribution to this fretwork disc of consort pieces by Martin Pearson, playing two more of the pieces by him from the Fitzwilliam book. Richard, was he a good virginalist? Was he writing these pieces for himself?
Well, he had a reputation as a virginalist in the first decade of the 17th century. So I think the answer has to be yes. And if he could play his own arrangement of Piper's Pavan by Dowland, which is the first of these two pieces, then yes, he was a good player. It's a very demanding piece.
Thank you.
Sophie Yates was the virginalist in those two pieces by Martin Pearson, Piper's Pavan and then The Primrose. How popular was his music during his lifetime, Richard? Was he as well known as some of the people who are better known nowadays?
No, I don't think so. He certainly had a reputation in his own time because he was published quite a lot. But then the publications he appeared in also included some composers that you possibly never heard of. But I think he did have a reputation, and you don't become an official at St Paul's Cathedral for nothing. So I would say that he had a higher reputation in his lifetime than he has now.
Why do you think he slipped into obscurity until you and the musicologists who inspired you in the 1960s got your teeth into his music?
I think for the reason that any unknown composer doesn't get a hearing. There are always composers that you know about who are known to be good composers. No one would pretend that Pearson was a William Byrd, for example, or a Tomkins. But the fact that he doesn't have the name shouldn't stop us listening to his music and assessing it properly. Once we assess it, we find that it's much better than it might have been. Much better, in fact, than it looks, in the case of Pearson. He always sounds better than the music looks. Just the rhetorical aspect of Pearson's music is very clear, it's very direct, and it's very approachable by anybody who enjoys music.
A Fantasia in D minor by Martin Pearson, played by the ensemble Fretwork. And that brings us to the end of today's Early Music Show. My thanks to Richard Rastall, Professor Emeritus at the University of Leeds, for talking to me today.
Today's Early Music Show was presented by Catherine Bott. It was produced in Salford by Les Pratt. On next Saturday's programme, Lucy Skeeping will present a profile of the American-based wind ensemble Pifero. She'll talk to their two artistic directors, Joan Kimball and Robert Wienken. That's next Saturday's Early Music Show at the usual time, just after the 1 o'clock news. And don't forget that from Monday, you can download our weekly podcast version of the Early Music Show. You just go to the Radio 3 website and then follow the links to the Early Music Show homepage. Well, Monday's also the day we cross live for a lunchtime concert at Wigmore Hall in London. That's at 1 o'clock. We're going to be there, though, in just a moment to hear a recital of late string quartets by Shostakovich in our Sunday concert this week. And if you were with me last night here on Radio 3, then you would have enjoyed our live relay from the Metropolitan Opera in New York, La Traviata, last night. Next week, attention turns to the Teutonic.
Wagner's Siegfried, live from New York. Part 3 of the Ring Cycle in Opera on 3, live from the Met. J. Hunter Morris sings the title role with Deborah Voigt and Bryn Terfel. Wagner, from the Metropolitan Opera, Saturday afternoon on BBC Radio 3, from 4 o'clock.
This is Radio 3. It's just after 2 o'clock now. Choral Evensong this afternoon comes from the chapel of the Old Royal Naval College in Greenwich. That's at 4. But now it's time for this week's Sunday concert, which this week is presented by Catherine Bott.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall for the first of two concerts given by the Pacifica Quartet. The quartet has been performing the complete cycle of quartets by Dmitri Shostakovich over the past couple of seasons, and in this concert we're going to hear the 11th, 12th and 13th, works which were written in the late 1960s. The last two quartets will follow next Sunday afternoon. Shostakovich only began writing chamber music in earnest in the mid-1930s, when his career seemed to be in ruins. The Communist Party was holding him up as a prime example of disloyalty and individualism. He'd made a tremendous reputation in all the big, outgoing musical forms, the symphony, concerto, opera, ballet, and now he found himself turning inwards. His professional disgrace was to bring about a complete reinvention of himself as a musician. And his 15 quartets, the first written in 1938, the last in 1974, are ranked among the greatest of the 20th century. During a rehearsal break, I talked to two members of the Pacifica Quartet about a possible source of inspiration for the quartets in this concert. We'll hear first from viola player Masumi Per-Rostad.
These quartets are actually dedicated to members of the Beethoven Quartet, so each one of these three quartets that we're playing tonight have a different member of the Beethoven quartet that they were dedicated to. The 11th quartet was dedicated to the second violinist, the 12th quartet to the first violinist, and the 13th to the viola player. And it's interesting, his different treatments kind of highlighting or isolating and acknowledging different members of a quartet.
You know, Shostakovich did have a very personal relationship to the Beethoven quartet. In some ways, especially in working in their rehearsals on his quartets, he was present. And so he was like a fifth member of the group. And so I think that these quartets are, I mean, all of his music is incredibly personal, but especially these quartets. And there's such a sense of sadness in this 11th quartet. And really, I mean, just the way it opens with the first violin playing alone, this incredibly lonely sort of feeling. I think that, you know, it's one of his most understated, deeply felt pieces.
Simin Ganatra, first violinist of the Pacifica Quartet. Shostakovich's quartet number 11 in F minor was composed in January 1966. After writing his 8th quartet, Shostakovich decided that each one that followed would have a different number of movements, and this one has 7, played without a break. Nevertheless, it's a compact work with a sense of perpetual motion and evanescence. It's dedicated to the memory of the second violinist of the Beethoven quartet, who had died the previous summer. And now, coming onto the platform at Wigmore Hall to play the 11th quartet by Shostakovich, are the members of the Pacifica Quartet.